All right, tonight we are continuing to study the scientific apologetics. And today we are getting really meaty part, the so-called objections of quote-unquote science to Genesis. The reason I want to put a quote around this the word science is because we can find out that the objections are really due to presuppositions and not by irrefutable facts and logic. So the subtitle is Beware of Presuppositions. We should always beware of assumptions, right? Because assumptions can always be wrong. If you have a theory, the biggest principle is usually an assumption, it's a belief. And then you have reason, and you have facts, and then you have reason that go from that, then you reach a conclusion. Science tries to minimize the role of faith or assumptions. They try to base as much as possible on facts and on logic. So it is science, it's truth based on things from below. You know the facts, and then you build on reasons, and you're trying to seek out the bigger principles. However, science cannot be totally free from assumptions. All theories have to be have some assumptions, and tonight we're going to talk about some issues that science had issues with Genesis 1. The first of all is the problem of absolute space-time. We know that Sir Isaac Newton is a great scientist. He is basically the founder of modern science, although he's more of the one who harvested rather than planted. We know that science really grew out of medieval theology. In medieval theology, they changed from Platonism to Aristotelianism. You know, Plato and Aristotle, right? Plato is the one who believed in everything that is finite and visible have something behind them that is invisible, that is the reason of their being. Like the table, behind every table there's a something called tableness, and that's something that makes the things table, and the tableness lives in the world of forms. The world of the forms is invisible, it's high up, but actually it's more noble, it's eternal, because table may disappear, but tableness never does. So that is Platonism. Platonism succeeded in trying to explain the things, that visible things, whatever is linking the visible things, okay? And why tables look different, but we call all of them table, okay? So Platonism was successful for a long period, for about 1,000 years, until later Aristotelianism took over. And Aristotle believes that the so-called forms or the universals are nothing but the essence of the particulars, and so there's not a separate world for it. And so Aristotelianism is not basing everything from above, but basing from below. So it opened the door to science. And in medieval theology, they changed from Augustinian Platonism to the Thomism, Thomas Aquinas, Aristotelianism, and that opens the door to modern science. First of all, it tried to explain everything with Christian theology and with logic, and that's called systematic theology. Okay, and because they believe all truth is God's truth, and therefore they try to explain a lot of detailed things that today we think are meaningless, like how many angels can dance on a pinhead of a needle. Today we'll think it's meaningless, but at that time, because everything needs to be explained by Christian theology and logic. And the known science at that time. So they debated everything. And it became somewhat redundant and boring. And so therefore, there's one important guy. He's called William of Ockham. And he proposed the idea of Occam's razor. He says, in all theories, the presuppositions need to be minimized. Because the more presuppositions you have, the more likely that the theory could be wrong. If one of them is wrong, the whole thing is wrong, right? So you minimize the presupposition, that's called Occam's razor. If you can't prove this concept is necessary, then you just eliminate it. And that is the beginning of science, scientific thinking. And then it's Francis Bacon who systemized the scientific method. And therefore, from then on, it opens the door for modern science. Okay, and for the first people who did modern science are really Copernicus and Galileo, and but they are the ones that really are exploring. And Newton put everything together. He's the one that harvested the thinking of, which is really is the fruit of 1,000 years of medieval theological thinking, you know, into the Newton. And Newton basically proposed three laws for Newtonian physics. Remember the three laws of Newton, right? And so action and reaction, okay, and force and so on. And also he proposed the law of gravity. And so he used these things and he suddenly explained many things that couldn't be explained before. And he's crowned as kind of the father of modern science, and he's very revered. Be sure to know that Newton himself is a devout Christian. His Trinitarianism may have something that is peculiar, and if you really pick with him, he is a borderline heretic, but he is a scientist. He wants to, you know, explore exotic things, and that's his problem. But he is, generally speaking, he is a devout Christian. So he did not try to use science to disprove God or theism, anything. The problem is that the Newtonian physics supports a concept called absolute space and time. That if you study the physics, the first thing you study is mechanics, right? And in mechanics, everything is described by a particle. And a particle is marked by its position and its time, right? Where it is and how fast it's moving, right? So space and time is the key to describe things. And now, what is space? Well, you would think space is a three-dimensional Euclidean space. Euclid. Is a Greek mathematician, a geometrist. He proposed a Euclidean geometry, that there's a plane geometry, there is a three-dimensional geometry. And for his three-dimensional geometry, everything, the space is kind of like square, a cubic. You know, if you see the cubic, the three directions of a cubic are the three dimensions. So you have left and right, up and down, and the front and back, and that's the three dimensions of Euclidean space. And Newton just adopted that, and he thinks space is just straightforward, infinite, three-dimensional Euclidean space. And that's natural, because that's our first impression of reality, okay? And he also thinks that time is a uniform flow that never changes its rate, and the time and space are not related with each other, they are independent, and all of these are not bendable. Space is not bendable, and time are considered the containers, and matter and energy are considered things that is contained in the space and time. So they are not related, okay? So space and time are the containers. Think about as a bowl. And matter and energy, think about are balls in the bowl, okay? So you separate these things, and then you try to describe the position and speed of the ball in the bowl, and then you're into physics. So that's Newtonian physics. He is very successful, and therefore the philosophical, you know, Newton was successful scientifically. But space and time, let's be objective. Space and time are not actually physical concepts. They are actually philosophical concepts. because you cannot cut a space and give to me, right? You cannot cut a piece of time and give to me, right? You can observe a time by a clock, but you can only observe that's a representation of time, not the time itself. Okay, so space and time are some concepts that are ontological. That is something that is a being that is beyond our experience. It's something that you believe in. Okay, it's more of philosophical concepts than physical concepts, although they must be used for in physics. So space and time in Newtonian physics became this philosophical concept of absolute space and time. And being absolute means that they are independent, they're not related, they are unchangeable, they cannot be bent, and they are infinite. Space is infinite in all three dimensions, time is infinite in both directions, past and future. So that is the concept of absolute space-time. Remember, that's philosophical concepts, but it was supported by Newtonian physics, which is very successful in science, explains everything. It assumes only a few laws and explains everything known. So believing in absolute space-time become fashionable after Newton. But that idea of absolute space-time opens the door to naturalism. Because if the universe can be infinite, universe means space-time and matter and energy in it, the universe can be infinite in both size and time, anything, if it's infinite, then it could be absolute. That means it's eternal. If anything is eternal, you are regarding that thing as God, or you expanding your idea of God into that thing. Okay, so beware of anything eternal. And the Newton himself believes in the first push. Now, in Newtonian physics, you must have a first push in order for things to start moving. See, Newton explained the solar system, okay, the gravity, the law of gravity. Explain the solar system, how the planets go around the sun in near circular but actually elliptical orbits. And they, because of that gravity, and they have to move in that orbit, in those orbits. And the problem is, if you don't start it, if you don't start to move that, it won't. But once you start it, it should go on forever. Okay? So Newton believes in a first push. Whether they go on forever, there's another issue of friction and the disturbance. Could that make them be disrupted? And yes, it could be. It's a miracle that they have not changed much. So either that means the system is designed so meticulously accurate, or that the time has not been very long. Okay. But we're talking about the beginning. It must have a beginning to put it into such a speed and position in order to start the system. So Newton believes that there must be a first push, therefore there must be a first pusher, that is God. So Newton believes the necessity of God for nature to run as it is. But the Newtonian worldview opened the door to deism, naturalism, and even atheism. Because if the universe can be infinite, itself can be God. Okay. So many today, many believers of Newtonian physics went further than Newton himself. Remember, in any heresy, you can consider modern atheism, naturalism, and naturalism, all are Newtonian heresies. They are initiated by Isaac Newton. But himself didn't believe in that far. He didn't go that far. Himself is an orthodox believer. Okay? But his followers went further than him. You can find that in many heresies. The founder of the heresy sometimes is not a heretic. He is the person who finds a problem with the current system. He tries to correct it, and he proposed a solution. But he did not know where this solution will go and where it should stop. So his followers goes beyond the founder and went into heresy. And later people have to correct that and come back. And you can later, if we talk about theology, we'll find out theology often goes by swinging, you know, left and right and left and right. The deity of Christ, humanity of Christ, and so on, until you reach somewhere that's stable. Okay. So many followers of Newton went further than Newton himself, and they went into naturalism and then deism and atheism. Many today still hold the intuitive concept of absolute space-time. That is natural, because you do feel space and time are independent, unchangeable, and infinite. And today, many people who do not follow science very well, they still think that believing in absolute space-time is scientific and modern. Okay? Marx and Engels, they wrote much about science, and their belief is absolute space-time, infinite time for the universe, and so universe is all there is. That's where atheism started from. Okay, from so the so-called Newtonian heresy, but Newton himself didn't believe it. The problem is Newtonian physics finally met its Occam's razor. In Newtonian physics, there are two ways to describe things. If you want to describe things locally, you think it's a particle. Okay, like a ball, you think a ball, even though it's big, if it's round, you think it's a particle. And if you hit it, it moves, you know, that way with a direction, a trajectory, and so on. So you just think in terms of the ball as its center of gravity and where it goes. Okay, so that's one way to, if you think about things locally, you use the model of a particle, even though particle doesn't really exist in reality. I mean, a point. There's no point in reality. In reality, particles are always have some kind of a shape and size and so on, but there's no absolute point, right? Or line, or circle, right? Those are concepts in human minds. You just use these concepts to describe reality as approximate modeling, okay? And but if you describe things collectively, sometimes you can use another concept called waves. Waves is when things move together. You know, when you drop a stone in the pond, you create waves, and the waves travel outward, right? Outwards, and that's water particles moving together. That's waves. So either locally or globally, we call them globally, or collectively, you use these two models. Particles or waves. And the issue of light and electromagnetic wave became a controversy for a while, because Newton himself considered light as particles. And light does behave like particles when it interacts with things. But light also behaves like waves. It can be bent, and it can change its color, you know, separate its color, and so on. And so light is both a particle and a wave. That will lead into modern physics. One of the modern physics is quantum mechanics. When things are going to microscopic size, they are both particle and waves. So light finally was explained as an electromagnetic wave. But if you have a wave, you need a medium to travel in. Think about it. Sound wave, you know, water, the water waves, what medium do they travel in? In water, right? How about sound waves? In the air, right? Or water, right? They have to have particles interact with each other, right? In order for the waves to go. So once light was explained very well by Maxwell and Hertz and so on as electromagnetic waves, then you must assume there is a medium for light to travel in. So that's the natural thinking of Newtonian physics. Okay, so Newtonian physics had to assume something called ether. Ether is a medium for light to travel in. Okay, it's invisible; you don't see it. But it must exist because light does travel in space. So space must be filled with something called ether. You just consider it as kind of a very thin jello, okay? And so light travel in it, and you can't experience because it's very thin, but it's just a jello-like, you know, elastic, so it can vibrate. That's how wave travel in it, okay? That's ether. That's the natural idea, okay? It's kind of like air, okay? But, or water, you know, but it's called ether. Now, if there is an ether, you should be able to make an experiment on that, because the Earth rotates around the sun, right? And it changes directions, right? In the springtime, it goes this way, and in summer, it goes that way, right? So the Earth goes in different directions, vertical directions, right? In spring and in summer, right? And if you let light travel in a specific direction on the Earth, and we know that speed should add up, right? When you throw something on a car, the speed is combined with the speed of that thing relative to you is combined with the speed of the car, right? If it's in one direction, it's going to enhance it, the other direction is going to decrease it, right? So if it's vertical, then they add up together and become in that direction, right? It combines, it changes direction. So natural thinking of Newtonian physics. So two people, Michelson and Morley, made an experiment called Michelson-Morley experiment. They measured the speed of light, you know, in two seasons, spring and summer, and they tried to find if there's any difference. Because the Earth changes directions, right? And you should find a slight difference. The problem is they cannot find any difference. And it's within the accuracy, the precision of the of experiment. So that was the nemesis, the death bell for Newtonian physics. Because now ether cannot be detected. Now, science is based on observable things, right? If things, see, science and philosophy, you usually think something, this is scientific, that means it can be observable, it's reliable. So if say, this is just philosophy, means it's just an idea, it may be true or maybe false, right? And, or we say, that's theology, or that's philosophy, that's not fact. Okay, basically you have a connotation, something that is unverifiable, then it probably may not be true. Right, and science is supposed to be based on observable things. Science should be based on repeatable things. If it's repeatable, then you can do an experiment on it, and if you find out it's always like that, then you will be sure about the theory. That, and then later, people can use that theory to benefit people. Okay, that's what technology is, right? So, if science assumes something that cannot be observed, it probably doesn't exist. From a scientific point of thinking, you should not assume these things unless you have to. And but if this thing is absolutely cannot be observed, then you should consider the possibility that that thing doesn't exist. Okay, so that is Occam's razor. Now, philosophy of science comes to the work. So this is how Newtonian physics developed into relativity and modern and quantum mechanics. That's when Newton had to assume, Newtonian physics had to assume something that's unobservable. And therefore came this guy called Albert Einstein. He assumed one principle. He made a Gedanken experiment, means thinking experiment. He thinks, what if I'm traveling with light wave? I'm at a speed with a light wave. What will it look like? Will they have a shape or vibration or whatever? So when he was young, he started to think. And then when he was a young man in his 20s, he made this theory called the special theory of relativity. He added one assumption that if light is the speed of light is the same in all reference systems. Okay. Usually, we believe that speed will have to combine with the speed of the reference system, okay? Right? When you throw a ball this way on the train, and the ball's actual speed to the ground will be added up with the speed of the train, right? But he says for light, this thing is different. Light's speed to an observer on the ground is the same as to an observer on the train, So the speed of light doesn't change to the reference systems. Okay, and this is a very peculiar assumption. But if you add this assumption in, then a lot of unexplainable things in Newtonian physics are now explained. Okay, so this is how science works. Usually, science is based on observable facts, like your intuition that space and time are unchangeable, square, infinite, and so on. But there are times when you have to let reason take control. Because if reason cannot explain this many things, but if you add this assumption, that will explain it all, even though this assumption is something that is counterintuitive, then you have to accept that. So this is how Einstein, he says, if we assume this principle, the invariance of the speed of light, okay, invariance in form of physical laws in different reference systems, then it solves many problems. So there are now the speed and space and time are linked together now. They're called space-time, space-time, one thing. And if something goes fast and as fast, to be close to the speed of light, then it's the clock on it will start to be delayed. Okay, so there's a lengthening of time. There's a shrinking of space. So space and time are linked together. They're all related with their speed, and they are changeable. Space can be, shrinked, and the time can be lengthened or expanded. Also matter and energy are linked together. And they're called matter energy or energy matter. Yeah, whatever, probably called energy matter these days. Yeah, and have you seen that E equals mc squared, right? E is energy equals mass times speed of light squared. Speed of light is a big number. It's about 300,000 square kilometers per second. It's a big number. And if you square that, that's a huge number. So very small mass can create huge energy. And that is verified by the atomic bomb, right? If you convert that mass into energy, it's going to destroy many things. And so special theory of relativity is absolutely verified with experiments, okay? He assumed one principle, he explained unexplainable things, and he expanded science to now explain much more. And that's how science progresses. And this is special theory of relativity. And now space and time are linked together. And now even space-time and energy matter are linked together. Because Albert Einstein made another theory called the general theory of relativity. He proposed another principle as an assumption, that gravity is the result of the bending of space. So gravity can be simulated by an acceleration. So think about it. If you are in an elevator, okay, the elevator is going down in the speed with the acceleration, of gravity. Now, would you feel any gravity in there? You don't feel anything there, right? And so gravity can be simulated with acceleration, and the bending of space would be a force, make a force and acceleration in it. So anyway, that's a big story. But anyway, if you assume this, then again, it can explain a lot of things unexplainable before. And all of the physical laws are now united in form. So that's why Einstein called his theory, rather than relativity, but he said it should be called the theory of invariance. Invariance means the form of physical laws does not change in physical systems, in reference systems. So he made matter, energy matter, and space-time related. This is this theory is confirmed by experiment in observing the bending of light around the sun. In the, I think it's 1930s, there was a solar eclipse. When you have solar eclipse, then the sky becomes very dark, right? And then you should be observing some stars behind the sun. Usually you can't see it, right? But when it's blocked, then you can't see it. And there is a star, a so-called a double star that's behind it. And when the sun is supposed to cover it, you cannot see it anymore. But somehow, if the light can bend around it, then you can think the star is still there, when it actually is not there anymore, right? So you will observe, as the sun is moving this way, you observe this star a little longer than you should. And that is what is observed. So that proved that around the big mass, space is bent. When it's bent, then light would travel. Light, by definition, goes by straight line, by the shortest distance. That's called straight line in space. So if the space is bent, light would also bend. Interesting, you call a bent space straight line. But the shortest distance is the definition of straight line, remember, in relativity. So that is confirmed by experiment, even though the assumption is kind of counterintuitive, but the acceptance of it would explain so many things, and it's confirmed by experiment, and now you have to accept it. So now the two theories of relativity absolutely changed the concept of space and time. And now, space-time is one thing, energy-matter is one thing, and even these two are one thing. All existence are one thing. You now cannot consider that space-time as the container and energy-matter as the contained thing. They are one creation. They are all related together. And also the idea of the absolute space-time is shattered. The philosophical concept of space and time supported by science now is not absolute space and time anymore. It is called relative space-time. And the being relative means that they are related, that space and time and energy and matter, they are related. And they are changeable. They can be bent and shrinked or lengthened. And they are finite. Together, they are finite. There is a boundary for it. And that would change your concept of space and time. Have we seen this, right? And in absolute space and time, it's like parallel lines in the Euclidean geometry. The parallel lines, do they meet? Do they ever meet? No, they never meet, right, in Euclidean geometry. But if you have tilted the lines, would they meet? They will, right? They will meet. And what if I tell you that the space and time now are like the tilted lines, and they happen to meet at a point, seems to meet at a point, and then they expand it now. We only have a limited time of observation. We only observed this part, okay? This part. But we can try to extrapolate our theory to the past. And there is no guarantee that they meet at the point. But that is one of the possibilities. And that's actually where the Big Bang theory came from, okay? The Big Bang theory came from this concept of absolute space and time, that they meet. There is a beginning, and also the law called Hubble's law. Edwin Hubble is an American astronomer, and he observed the stars, and he found that the distance of the stars and the speed of the stars seems to be in a linear proportional relationship. Now, all stars seem to be leaving us. All stars are going in all directions, leaving us, going away. And the further they are, the faster they move. Okay. That is Hubble's law. And then today we found that Hubble's law is an approximation, and it's not absolute. But generally speaking, it's correct that all stars are leaving us, and they seem to leave us in uniformly, in isotropically, in all directions, and away from us. And that would suggest to us actually we are at the center of the universe, doesn't it? If we're not at the center, then we're going to explain some difference in different directions. Right now, we see no difference in all directions. They are the same, uniform, isotropic. And but because the non-believers don't believe that the Earth is the center of the universe, absolutely, they don't believe it. So they assume a principle that the Earth is not the center of the universe, that the expansion should be the same, the stars that leave each other in the same way to all other stars, not just to us, but stars relative to all each other. It's like on a balloon. You know, when you explode a balloon, when you expand a balloon, blow it, and all particles will leave each other, you know, in every space toward each other. That is how they explain it. But that is, again, assumption. But generally speaking, when you have the relative space and time, then you will not think of an infinite universe, and that has eternal in being. Okay, the universe cannot have an eternal being; it must have a beginning, and how it began actually is not absolutely knowable by today's science, because you only observed a short time now, right? And if you go back, there could be many ways that the universe began. It could start from this one point, like the Big Bang theory, or it could be starting with the Bent physical laws. You know, at the beginning, the physical laws, you know, when you extrapolate theories, you have to assume that the physical laws don't change in order to expand, right? But the laws, again, they could change. If they change, then they are not necessarily straight and going to that one point. It could go in some other way. And it also could be like what the Word of God says. God said, let there be, and there was. So there could be a beginning point, not necessarily in that absolute point, but somewhere in the middle, God just said, let there be, and then there was, like now. And then they start to expand, like in the Bible says, God stretched the universe. So this is now the idea, model of space and time. So now we have seen that the so-called, the first objection of science to Genesis is now solved because of Einstein's theory of relativity. Okay, the concept of absolute space and time is not supported anymore. Okay, the concept of absolute space-time is not supported anymore by science. Okay, you remember it's philosophical concept. Now the one that's supported by science is the relative space and time. And so if anybody is still holding the idea of absolute space and time, that there is an absolute time, uniform flow, infinite, the universe is infinite, and it was there in the beginning like it's now, it's called steady state, they have not caught up with science. Okay, today there are still a few scientists that hold on the steady state universe theory, but that is not very popular now, even though it's still existing. But generally, the idea of space and time, the one that's supported is the relative space and time. And now there is another question related. It's called the starlight problem. We know once we, because of Hubble's law, we now know a lot more stars than before, and we know that they are all leaving us. We can observe the speed of the stars quite accurately by knowing their red shifts. Have you heard of the word red shift? Okay, you know, all stars have lights that coming to us and we receive it. Okay, and the lights in their lights we can separate with a spectrum and see their spectrum. You know, light have a spectrum of different frequencies, okay? And for each element, and they have their peculiar specific spectrums, like let's say sodium. It has these few lines at these frequencies because it has this atomic structure, and light jumps from one energy level to the next. Radiate a beam of light at that frequency because of that energy difference. You know, thinking about the atoms as electrons moving around orbits, around kind of like a solar system. Okay, and this is a proxy model. But quantum mechanics tells us that these orbits are quantum; they are not continuous. There are only a few allowed orbits. So if an electron will change its state, it can move from a higher energy state to a lower energy state by jumping. Once it jumps, it lowers its energy and it will radiate out a light. That its energy, its frequency is determined by its energy equal to the difference between the two orbits. You see that? Okay. So in any element, they have their specific lines. So if you see in the spectrum of the light, let's see from the sun, and you separate it, and you find these are from the helium, these are from the hydrogen, and so on, because they have their specific lines, okay, and spectrum. And the star lights, they show similar groups like this. You see iron, okay? You see sodium, okay, with these lines. The problem is all of those as a whole, see, all of the iron spectrum moved a little bit to the red side. That means the lesser energy side moved a little bit and uniformly. And that's called red shift, okay? The spectrum of the light because you can detect that spectrum belongs to this element. That means the star have that element, right? But all of those move a little bit, to the red side, and that's called red shift. When you have red shift, the light's energy gets smaller, and it's like a slowing. Of its speed, although light doesn't slow its speed. And think about from sound. Okay, have you seen the trains passing from you? Have you heard from it? When it comes to you, it's free. If they put on the a horn. Okay, or whistle, whatever, whistle. Okay, if they put on the whistle, and then when it comes to you, that it will sound higher than normal, but once it passes you, then it becomes lower. Okay, so it becomes when it passes you. So when it comes to you, the frequency goes higher. When it leaves you, the frequency gets lower. And this is something is called Doppler shift. Doppler is a German scientist that found it out and named after him. So if something is leaving us, then its frequency gets lower. The waves from it will have lower frequency. That's called Doppler shift. Okay. Well, the stars, at first, most people think, okay, the stars there have red shift. That means the light has lowering its frequency. That means they are leaving us. They thought this is due to Doppler effect. Okay. Doppler effect is like the stars in moving away in space. The space is not moving. Okay, the stars moving away in space from us. That's Doppler effect. Now, this concept now is not fashionable anymore. Because now we found out it's not that the stars moving away from us, it's that the space is stretched. The space is expanding. And the stars are actually staying their position in space. Think about now that the space is a plastic paper with grids, okay, draw on it. And the stars are put on their places. And when you stretch this plastic paper, the grid gets expanded, right? So the space is expanded. And the stars do move away from us, but they do not move away in space. Okay, they stay in their position in space. But the space itself is stretched. And everything is moving away from us. Okay, this is now the better picture of cosmology. And there was a problem for creationists, because we know, according to the Bible, that the universe is just about 4,000 years old. I mean, 6,000 years old, starting about 4,000 BC. Then, if the stars are so far away, how can the light reach us in that short of time? Okay, you see, I put the solution. I wrote this, remember, around 20 years ago. And I put the solution that is by many creationists. God created the light as part of the creation. He created stars there. He created the light in between. And he just let the light to be synchronized with the stars. And therefore, we see the light. And as if it comes from the stars. You know, this will be problematic for some people, because they think then God is deceiving us. Because this light carries information of physical process, okay? Something like an explosion of a supernova, okay? It's a physical process, right? But if it didn't happen that long ago and God put the light there, isn't God tricking us? Some people will think that way, okay? And it's reasonable. And I didn't have a better solution, so I just said, I believe it by faith. I put it there. You can see me thinking 20 years ago like that, okay? But now, thank God, there is a better solution. So right now, we know that the theory of relativity has progressed. The theory of relativity, we had a special theory, and we have a general theory, right? And now there is a third one that's called the cosmological relativity. So we have special relativity, and we have general relativity, and we have now something called cosmological relativity. And all of these two are by Albert Einstein. And this one is by a Israeli scientist. He's a Jew. He's not a Christian. Okay, a Israeli scientist. I don't know if he is a believer of God, but he is a Jew. He's called Moshe Carmeli. Moshe, I think. Yeah. Moshe Carmeli. The reason that he invented it, it's told that he invented this while he was having a dinner, having a lunch, actually. He wrote down the basic questions on a napkin. Sometimes inspiration comes that way, you know. And the reason he had to do this is because about the Hubble's law, right? Hubble's law. Hubble's law basically is saying the speed the stars leaving us is proportional to their distance from us. Okay. Now the speed, we can measure it by the redshift. Okay. We can calculate it pretty accurately, but the distance is a problem. Okay. The distance is a problem. Why? Well. Think about it. If you have, how do you measure the speed of the distance of a star from us? You know, the Earth goes around the Sun, right? The distance between the Earth and the Sun is called one astronomical unit. If you have stars that's not far away, and if you let the Earth, you measure its position in different seasons, then you will see a difference around the stars. And by that, you can calculate its distance, right? And this is called the method of parallax, okay? The method of parallax. And that works only for stars that are not so far away. So, oops. if we have, you know, we know this is the sun, this is the earth going around it, and so the earth is in different positions at different seasons, right? And if you have a star that's not far away, you can measure it in different seasons, you can see a little difference, right? And that is the method called a parallax. But this can only measure stars not far away, because it's too far away, the distance between the Earth and the Sun is too small, and the change will be too small to detect, so that will not be measurable. This way can only measure stars within about 100 light years. That's very small in astronomy. So what to do with others? Well, a series of assumptions have to be assumed. Okay, there are some stars that are variable. They change by their brightness. And if you assume the relationship of their distance with them and assume a few galaxies are at a certain distance, then you can get the results of other stars. So now you know that the distance of the stars are not able to be measured accurately. Okay, for far away stars, you cannot do that. So Hubble's law, therefore, cannot be considered as absolutely trustable experimental law, because you simply cannot measure the distance accurately, precisely. Okay, you have to measure, reach a conclusion by a series of physical assumptions. Okay, that would take a whole hour to talk about that. But you know that they are not necessarily right. They could be, they could not be. Okay, they could be wrong. So rather than assuming that the challenging the Hubble's law, and it seems generally correct, you know, it's self-consistent, but it's not absolutely measurable. So the way Moshe Carmeli did it is that he assumes that Hubble's law is assumed as a principle rather than an experimental result. So he assumed this as a principle, like Einstein assumes that light, speed of light doesn't change in different reference systems. So Moshe Carmeli simply assumes Hubble's law as a fundamental principle. Okay, and then put into that, then all of the, it's not space-time, it's not three variables. It's space, time, velocity. Actually, it's space velocity is the basic measurement in his system. But anyway, it's a big system that contains the Einstein system as a subset of it. So he can reduce to Einstein theory. This is an expansion of it. And by this, there is a Christian believer that can use this principle to reach something else. We know that all theory science should be careful about its assumptions, right? Especially when you have something that is inobservable. Now, by Einstein's general theory of relativity and by Hubble's law, you naturally will reach the theory of Big Bang. Okay, Big Bang theory is basically extrapolating the current observed theories back to a point. Okay, to a one absolute beginning, and at that point, all physical laws are not there yet. They just assume that it just started, and all order started from this order, and it came into order. That actually is against the second law of thermodynamics, right? So, because order naturally don't appear, but Big Bang theory is an extension of these two: general theory of relativity and the Hubble's law, and the problem is that for Big Bang theory, it has a problem like the starlight problem for creationists. They have a big, big problem that they usually don't tell you. Because according to observation, the universe seems to be expanding in a uniform speed, not speeding up or slowing down. And in order to keep that, the Big Bang Theory, they estimated the mass. You know, mass are attractions, right? By gravity, general law of gravity, they are attractions. If you have too much mass in the universe will expand to a certain extent, then it will come down, it will shrink, right? If you have too little, then it's going to accelerate, right? And right now, it seems to be going uniformly. So you have to assume it has a critical mass, right? But the observed mass in the universe, it's much, much smaller. That's less than 30%, maybe less than 10% of the assumed critical mass necessary for keeping the speed. So that is a big problem for the Big Bang theorist. And their way of dealing with it is to assume something called dark matter and dark mass. They're dark, so they're unobservable, but they're there. Do you see the problem of the ether? Right? Something that's non-observable, but you have to assume it in order for your theory to work. Well, maybe they just don't exist. Would you consider that issue? Right? So right now, with the theory of the cosmological relativity, another scientist, his name is John Hartnett. He is an astronomer. He happens to be a Christian and also a fundamentalist Christian. He believes in young Earth creationism. He is a fully accredited scientist. He actively works in the field of astronomy. He used the cosmological relativity, and he explained away dark matter and dark energy. And dark matter. You don't need to assume it. And I think this contribution deserves the Nobel Prize. This is my personal opinion. I don't know if he could get it. You know, usually they give it according to a certain discoveries. So if he finds some, predicts something and it was confirmed, then he probably can get it. But you know, Albert Einstein was not given his Nobel Prize for relativity. It's given for his photoelectric effect. You know, because they are wary about these novel theories. But anyway, I think the level of contribution is up to that level, because for science, explaining away the something that is assumed but unobservable is a great contribution. Okay, and by the way, he also solved the starlight problem for the creationism, because when we know that the Bible says that God created the stars on the third day, He created the heavens and earth, which means the space. Okay, in the first day, space and time in the first day, but He created the stars, put the stars in their position on the fourth day. Okay. And then God stretched the universe. God stretched the heavens in the Bible, right? When He stretched the heavens, the space would expand. Okay, so think about that plastic paper. Okay, gets stretched, the grid expanding. So the stars are moving away from us. Not necessarily they're moving in their position in space, but they're just moving away from us. And because the space is stretched, according to the theory of relativity, there is a time expansion factor. It goes by exponentially, you know. So it can go very big. So the time for stars out there in space is not the same as time here on Earth. Okay, and because of our observation, now we see the uniform isotropic in background radiation and moving away from us in all directions, it is natural to assume that our galaxy is at the center of the universe. Okay, this is the most natural conclusion, unless philosophically you are against it by theological reason. You don't believe in any center of the universe. That's what today's Big Bang theorists, they have to impose another principle on it, which is not supported by any facts. Actually, the facts supporting that this galaxy is at the center of the universe. Okay, and if you accept this simple facts, then time on earth is what matters. And time elsewhere is expanded by that stretching of space. So the lights from those stars went going through a great distance to reach us. But that doesn't mean that the time has gone that far on this earth. For those lights, they went through that time for their system. But on earth, it's just 6,000 years. Okay, so there is no conflict now for the long distance, many billions of light years, with the short time on Earth. There's no conflict because of this time expansion factor. Okay, so this problem is solved. It's no longer a scientific problem. If you think there's a problem, that is because of your theological and philosophical assumption, not because that you're pushed by facts and you have to take it. So today we have dealt with the two issues of the first two objections. Basically, they are physical issues. The absolute space and time and starlight problem. And we found out that the objections were based on philosophical assumptions, and these philosophical assumptions were supported by science for a while. But because science progresses, right? Science is never final. Even today, science cannot say it's final. Okay? If you base your theology on science, then next day your whole theology could be wrong. And that's why apologists for the Bible need to be careful. You use science as support, but not as the base of your theology. Okay. And today we can use science as a support. For a while, science was the enemy of religion. But now as science matures, it becomes a friend of religion. Now it can be used to explain the shortness of the history of the universe for the time clock on Earth, for the clock on Earth, not for the clock on the moving away stars. Okay. And so the starlight problem is also solved by most recent progress in the theory of relativity, theoretical physics, and in astrophysics. By John Hartnett. He explained away the need for dark matter, dark energy. And that progress, I think, deserves Nobel Prize for scientific contribution and Templeton Prize for, you know, the Templeton Award is for a contribution related with science and religion. So I think it's that important because it solved my problem. You can see I'm still presenting my theory 20 years ago. That's the best I could get right now. It's much, much better. Now, last year, I went to the Evangelical Theological Seminary, but not seminary, Evangelical Theological Society. There's an annual meeting, and there was a seminar talking about modern physics and theology. I went to listen, but the author, the speaker never showed up. So after 10 minutes, I said, well, everybody's still here. Okay, I'll volunteer. I'll give you a talk on this issue. So it's recorded and it's now everywhere. I think this should be known by believers that this is not anymore a problem. And if anybody, they still insist that there's a problem, you need to tell them you're a little behind, you know, in science, in knowledge. And either you are behind in knowledge or you are obstinate in philosophy. So let them choose. Okay. And so let's praise God and send you home. Heavenly Father, thank you for gathering us tonight and give us a wonderful time to celebrate that all truth is your truth, not meaning that everything is on truth in the same level, but your truth does cover everything. And as science progresses and matures, you have made it more of a friend of religion than an enemy. Thank you for giving us this knowledge so that we can use that to defend our faith. Thank you for giving us your word, which is reliable. And sometimes we had to believe it by faith, but thank you now for letting us being able to believe both by faith and by reason and facts. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.